Okay, today we're going to continue speaking about Purim and the aspect of Purim we're going to speak about is drinking on Purim, which for a lot of people is drinking. For a lot of people, it's the main part of Purim. Forget about the Megillah, forget about Al HaNisim, forget about the Seudah. Drinking is the main thing, so we will consider the issue of drinking on Purim. For those of you who wanted a continuation from last week's class, I apologize. But perhaps if you drink enough, okay. Okay. First, a word of introduction before we get to the actual obligation, because I did carefully cut out from the Gemara this one line about drinking, but I think that we need to understand context. Before we get to what may be an absolute obligation or not an absolute obligation, I think we need to consider various other aspects of Purim. For example, Purim is the first, quote-unquote, rabbinic holiday. Being a rabbinic holiday, the rabbis, when they made this up, had to figure out what exactly will be its nature. So, for example, even though for us it's simple, that Purim and Hanukkah, you're allowed to do work, you're allowed to do melacha, that was not necessarily such a simple decision. And if you read carefully Megillat Esther, and if you read carefully the Gemara, it seems to be that there were those of the opinion that Purim should become, Hanukkah you don't see this, but Purim should become a proper holiday in the sense that there should also be an Isur Melacha. And if you're going to tell me that, no, it's a rabbinic holiday, we have a lot of rabbinic holidays with Isur Melacha, and it's called the second day Rosh Hashanah, or Yom Tov Sheni, generally. Chutz La'aretz, lots of people have a day which is rabbinic and nonetheless a prohibition of work. So the fact that it's rabbinic would not have necessarily impacted on the question of should there be or not be a prohibition of work. But what the rabbis did apparently do when they made up this holiday was, on the one hand, they said you're allowed to do melacha, which means on the one hand it is a regular day. Now, on the other hand, they did want to give some kind of specialness to it. So, presumably, the way that you do that, if you're Jewish, is that you make an obligation in terms of eating. Right? And you have an obligation for a su'udah. And the source of the su'udah can all the way go back to Megillat Esther. And by the way, it also talks about Yimei Mishteh. And Mishteh may very well have a connotation of drinking as well. But before I get to the drinking as drinking, we know that on Shabbat and on Chag, there's a thing called Kiddush. So Kiddush because it's Kadosh. Kiddush because you want to sanctify the Shabbat or the holiday meals. But Purim, where you don't have Kiddush, is there still an obligation, nonetheless, within drinking? Which means it is possible that the first stage of a concept at all of drinking on Purim could be just like a Kiddush on any other day. But the problem is there is no Kiddush, so now how do you fit in? I mean, there's no verses to read, there's no... So how do you introduce that? So it's possible that by saying, no, Purim, you should drink as well, aside from, because maybe that is even what makes it into a more festive meal than simply, than a weekday meal. I don't know about all of you, if you have a glass of red or white wine with dinner every night, or three times a day. If it's three times a day, that could be a problem. But with breakfast. But that can, as I said, that can be the element that makes it into something which is festive. A small what?
When was Purim put into the canon? When was it closed?
Most likely, that's the work that Anshei Knesset HaGdolah did, the men of the Great Assembly, which is the very beginning of the Second Temple, which means that when the Jews came back and completed the Second Temple, that's when the canon was made. That's when the decision to include Megillat Esther within the canon, and presumably that's also when it was introduced as a holiday.
So is that the reason why, even though Purim was the last Kitvei Kodesh to get into the canon, Ezra and Nehemiah are also there, and they take place afterwards?
Right, but it's again, when they come back and build the Second Temple. So that's the, therefore would be included. That's when the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah meet.
Okay,
no one knows. When I say I don't know, it's no one knows. Why do I say this? One of the big difficulties in terms of studying Jewish history are issues of chronology, and specifically the exact time of the story of Purim is not so simple as, you know, historically, when this happened. So presumably it happened between the First Temple and the Second Temple, although most likely it began after they started building the Second Temple, and then they stopped building the Second Temple. That's the background of the story, and then later on they continue building it after the events happen. So, as I said, the first tension that we have is Purim as a holiday, and Purim as a holiday, or as a quasi-holiday, or some type of holiday, or some kind of a special day, the rabbis would have wanted to put some kind of difference within the meal. And again, you don't have shnei lechem, right? You don't have to make a motzi on two rolls, as it were, because it's not a holy day like Shabbat or like Chag. But I think that the drinking within it on the very first stage would have been in order to separate that or to designate that meal as some type of a special meal. We find, and you have to appreciate the timing over here, much later on, you're talking 3rd century Amoraim. So you're talking about after the whole 2nd Beit HaMikdash, after the time of the Mishnah, all the way into the time of the Gemara, then we find the following sentence. In source number 1, Amar Rava, Rava said, Michayev Inish Levsume Bipurya. Now, one of the difficulties we're going to have right here is that this sentence is in Aramaic. And being it's in Aramaic, we're going to have to try to translate some of it. Amar Rava, Michayev Enish Levsume Bipurya. Purya means Purim. Enosh means Anashim, people. And the question is the word Levsume. And that you can debate whether the word, the English over here, chooses to translate it as a person. It is the duty of a man to mellow himself, to mellow oneself. Now, what does mellow oneself mean? Others can translate this in a much stronger way. Look at Rashi, source number 2, Livsume, Lehishtaker. So between Livsume as being to mellow versus Lehishtaker, to get drunk, there is obviously a very, very big difference. Why he would have said Michayev Enosh, and does Enosh mean, as it's translated over here, as specifically a man? Would anybody here consider the possibility that the obligation of drinking on Purim, if it is an obligation, is only on men and not on women? Which, by the way, I can assure you, you can find people claiming and writing about, but that's not all that reasonable. Because regarding the more serious obligations of the day, such as reading the Megillah, Al Hanisim, or anything else, women are included just like men. So why is that you've never heard any rabbis get up and say, I want to make sure that all the women are going to be drinking just like the men will be drinking?
The women have to clean up.
You're going to start drinking? But it's not just that it says they're obligated to drink, and I think anybody who translates this as saying a man is required, that's not what Enosh means. B'nei Enosh, at least in Hebrew, it means mankind. It's not meant to be interpreted as men, not women. Mechayev Enosh of Sumi Bipurya, a person is obligated to, let's just translate it right now, to become intoxicated on Purim. Ad delo yada, until he doesn't know, Bein Baruch Mordechai La'aror Haman. Until he doesn't know the difference between that Mordechai should be blessed and Haman should be cursed. Now, I don't know any of you and how much experience you have in drinking. Hopefully at least some, so that we can converse now. How much drinking does that sound like to get to that point? You're dealing with such a prodigious amount of drinking that the requirement over here seems completely irrational because or impossible. I mean, if you want, we can try this. We can go to the various bars and pubs and ask somebody, you know, we'll go at 3-4 in the morning and ask somebody, Hitler, was he a good person or was he a bad person? And I don't think that even the person who drinks to an incredible amount is going to necessarily get confused regarding that point. I just don't see it happening, which leads us to a problem, because first of all, does Rava mean this? And if Rava means this, then how technically is a person supposed to do this? And on top of all that, why would this be an obligation? I mean, why in the world would Judaism tell us, okay, Purim is a day, and that should be a happy day, and therefore get drunk out of your mind till you know the difference between good and evil, which is really what this is. The difference between Baruch Mordechai and Ur Haman is literally the problem between good and evil. I do want to note something within Rashi here. Rashi says, l'ifsume, which again is a word that I'm not sure any of us necessarily know the Aramaic to know exactly what it means. Rashi claims that l'ifsume means specifically l'hishtaker b'yayin. Rashi believes that the obligation of drinking on Purim is exclusively with wine. He doesn't say that the point is l'hishtaker. Again, he could have saved a word. He did not have to say to drink wine. He could have said just to drink or just to get drunk. But Rashi stresses l'hishtaker b'yayin. And in case you're not sure if that is on purpose or not, take a look at source number 7. The Rambam writes, Ketzad chovat sudazo. The Rambam writes, and what is the obligation regarding this su'uda? Now, I do want to stress something here about the Rambam. I started to tell you in the beginning that I took that line about drinking out of context. What context is it in? What was the Gemara talking about before and after? The Gemara is discussing su'udat Purim. When is the mitzvah of su'udat Purim, of the meal? When is the mitzvah of the meal? Only during the day. Which therefore means that there is not, that the mitzvah of drinking, if there is such a mitzvah of drinking, is a mitzvah which is connected to the day, not to the night before. And now, when you read the Rambam, you realize the Rambam is definitely explaining this and understands this within the context of the Gemara. He says, Ketzad chovat suda zo, what is the obligation regarding this meal? Sheyochal basar v'yitaken su'uda na'e kefi asher timtza b'yado. A person should have meat, and a person should make a nice meal as he can afford. V'shote yayin ad sheyishtaker. Now, the Rambam over here, we'll see at least the two or maybe three parts of what he's mentioning. First of all, he's telling us you need to have a nice meal. Why is he telling us this? That's what I keep saying from the beginning. Because being that it's not a Yom Tov, but it's not Shabbat, we need to define it that there needs to be a festive meal nonetheless. And that's the first part of what the Rambam says. Within the festive meal, the Rambam says that a person needs to drink. But again, the Rambam limits the drinking to the wine. To wine specifically. So you see both Rashi and the Rambam limited to wine. I guarantee you if you go telling this to people, they'll say, you know, if they said, you heard a rabbi say that you should drink on Purim only wine, they'll say, where'd you get that from? I just showed you where I got it from, even though people drink all kinds of things. I don't know anybody who specifically argues with them. And again, if you want to think a little bit deeper why this may be, there's a very simple explanation, which is already found in the Rishonim. And that explanation is because the various, let's just see if we found any of the Rishonim that actually say this. If you look at source number 11, the Abudraham, which is a book of ancient minhagim, and right now we will just look at the very end of the Abudraham, at the end of source 11. V'chein inyan haman, one second, even go a little bit before that. Go a little bit before that. In the middle, it says Vayesh Lomar Nesha Kol Hanisim Shanasul Yisrael B'Machashverosh Hayu Ayidei Mishte. All of the miracles that took place, or the whole story, is punctuated by discussions of drinking. Ki B'Tchila Nitrada Vashti Min Hamalchut Ayidei Mishte Yayin. Vashti was replaced due to wine. B'Yom Shvikatov Leiv Hamelech B'Yayin Omelaviat Vashti Uva Esther Tachteh, and therefore Esther replaced her, and that sets the stage for the eventual salvation. Ayidei Mishteh Shenem, Avayas HaMelech Mishteh Gadol L'Kol Sarev Avadav, Et Mishteh Esther, V'chein Inyan Haman U'Mapalato, and also Haman, and his eventually fall, Ayidei Mishteh Hayayin Haya, takes place because of wine. U'lechein Chayvu L'Shtakeh B'Purim, and therefore we have an obligation to drink on Purim, Nesha B'Hanes B'Vor Mishteh Hayayin, because the miracle took place with wine, Shasta Esther, where she made that party afterwards with wine. And therefore, by drinking wine, you'll remember the miracle that took place. So the Abudraham, even though he may not have said it black and white, absolutely, only drink wine, I think by the time you finish reading his source, you understand that's what he means. And as Rashi and the Rambam both pointed out, the mitzvah and Purim of drinking, therefore, is wine, because wine is what it's about. It wasn't about scotch, it wasn't about vodka, or it wasn't about using any kind of illicit drugs, because you could think that the main point is to get your mind to a point you don't understand anything. That's not what it says. It says is to use wine, which is how the miracle took place, in order to appreciate the miracle. Again, that's the way that he's understanding it. We are somewhat stuck still because the original formulation of Rava, which was a person should drink till he doesn't know the difference between that Mordechai should be blessed and Haman should be cursed, that's something which is quite difficult for us to understand. There was a question. There was not a question. Okay. Okay. I teach a course in Bar Ilan University on Agadah. And every year at the beginning of the year, I refuse to give an introduction because no one understands introductions in the beginning. You took that course? You remember that course? You remember anything from it? You remember I didn't give an introduction or no? You have the notes still? Purim is coming. I mean, Pesach is coming. And if not, then Lag BaOmer is coming. Anyway, the people don't know how to translate Agadah. So a lot of people, very important people, will say, what is Agadah? What is the stories? Agadah is the non-halakha of the Gemara. So Gemara is made of law and made of stories, and therefore the stuff which isn't law is stories. In this particular case, we just know how the law stated. What's the law? The law is a person should drink on Purim to a point which seems impossible. Then we have a story which follows it. The question over here is going to be, and we're going to see almost all of the Rishonim who try to deal with this are going to have to try to explain to us what is the law after this story was brought, which means there is a deliberate juxtaposition of a law and a story. Let's see what the story is. It says, Rabba, and you should realize that very often in the Gemara there may be intrigue, source number one, there may be intrigue regarding the names Rava and Rabba. Rava is with an aleph and Rabba is with a hay. There are various versions of this story that have one or the other. You also have, regarding the first line, Amarava may have been Amarabba, which causes incredible confusion. If we didn't have enough problems, if you're interested in reading about this, in source number 20, Rav Menashe Klein has a tshuva where he discusses this. Let's stay with the Gemara still, source number one. Rabba v'Rabbi Zera, of du sudat purim bahadi hadadi. Rabba and Ubzera, they did their Purim Suda together, which sounds very, very nice. Batar di Ibsum, after, Batar means after, Baba Batra is the last Baba, Baba Kama is the first Baba. After the Ibsum, they became intoxicated. Kam Rabba, Rabba got up, Vishachte the Rabbi Zera. And literally that means he performed Shchita on Reb Zera, which means he pulled a knife and he slit his throat. Lumachar, the next day, Bo'i Rachamei Alei Ba'achye, he prayed for him and he brought him back to life. Lashana, the next year, Amar Lei, one says to the other, presumably it's Rabba speaking to Reb Zera, Leitemar V'navid Sudat Purim B'hadei Adadi, come, sir, you're invited, let's do Purim together again. Amar Lei, he answers, Lav kol shata v'shata mitcharesh nisa. Literally, miracles don't happen every day. Thank you, but no thank you. So now, what does this story do to that original halakha? Again, the Gemara put them two together. I mean, if I were to say that an 18-year-old is speaking to his mother and says, today I'm 18, so I'm going to go drinking all night. And the mother then says, well, excuse me, there were some people that were drinking and then they got into an accident and that's the end of it. So then is the mother saying, yes, you should drink, or saying, no, you shouldn't drink? I mean, I don't have to explain this to you, right? So over here, when you have this story right afterwards, is it coming to disagree and telling you that no, that Rava is wrong and there is no mitzvah of drinking? And by the way, if perchance that all the way through it was Rabba, Rabba says you're obligated to drink, and then Rabba's the one who gets drunk, and then Rabba's the one who slits Reb Zera's throat, would Rabba then back down and say, you know what, maybe this is a mistake and I should go for counseling instead of going to invite people to come drinking? Although, we do have to admit that even if this is the case, and that's part of what Rav Klein in that tshuva deals with, he doesn't back down. The next year he wants to drink again, although Reb Zera is not a willing participant. Or I can have a completely opposite conclusion. And what would that be? The Gemara says you're obligated to drink on Purim to the point that you don't know the difference between that Mordechai should be blessed and Haman should be cursed. And how can I prove that this is the obligation? You look and you see that that's what people actually did. Now there's a slight problem with drinking to this point, and what's that? You might, you right. You may go and kill people that you like, or maybe don't like. But and again, we're back to the beginning, because that would be a very, very strange thing. And why would the halacha obligate this or encourage this if this is the if this is in fact the result that takes place? Therefore, among Rishonim and Achronim, we have various approaches how to look at the story. And by the way, there's a third approach, which I didn't get to. There's a third approach as well, that maybe the story is coming somehow to modify it, but we'll see if we have a chance to get back to that. Tosfot, if you look at source number 3, Tosfot mentions something which is not going to be completely clear. He says, "De lo yada ben Aru Harun ben Mordechai b'Yerushalmi Aru Zeresh Brucha Esther Arum Kol Rishayim Brucha Kol Yehudim." Does that sound familiar to you? From where? Shoshana Yaakov. He says you have to drink to the point that you can't say the song properly, and there are those who claim. Completely different thing. There are those who claim that there were much more verses to the song, and people used to get confused within the verses, which means sometimes you would respond Baruch Mordechai, and sometimes you would respond Arur Haman. So therefore, if you can no longer keep up with the song, because you can't keep track what you're supposed to say at this point, that means you had too much to drink. Now, how much drinking would that be? Well, if you want... Well, if you want that opinion, I'll show you something even better about that then. If you want to see that, you go back to the Budra Haman source 11. The Budra Haman says this, it's also in source number 9, but we're already there in 11, so we'll stay there. Yesh mefarshim ad shetichlef lo Haman b'Mordechai u'Mordechai b'Haman. And again, I believe he's referring to the singing. V'yesh mefarshim ki arur Haman ole l'minyan baruch Mordechai. So those of you who love gematria, and I know that most of you love it passionately, the gematria of Arur Haman, which I will do for you very, very quickly, an aleph is 1, a resh is 200, which gives you 201. A vav is 6, you're up to 207. Another resh is another 200, so what's that? 407. Haman, hey, that gets you to 12. Mem is 40, nun is 50, and that gets you to 502. And you are right, Baruch Mordechai, 502. And if you look at Baruch Mordechai, you'll see that Baruch Mordechai also adds up to 502. The bet is 2, the resh is 200, the 6, the vav is 6, the kaf is 20, mem is 40, resh is 200, dalet is 4, kaf is 20, and yud is 10. Again, 502. And those of you who cannot do the gematria, you've had enough to drink. And that's what he says, that if you can't do that math, then you've had enough. But what you're seeing over here are radically different approaches to the question, which means, is it that you drink to the point that you don't know the difference, that Mordechai should be blessed and how much should be cursed? And by the way, if you look back at the first source, the word Baruch and the word Arur doesn't necessarily make all that much sense. If it wanted to say you know the difference between Haman and Mordechai, so then it just should have said Haman and Mordechai. Why does it say Baruch Mordechai and Arur Haman, that Mordechai should be blessed and Haman is cursed? What does that add to it? So the Tosfot, following the song that he sees in the Rishonim, says, no, that's the chorus of the song, so that's why it's there. On the other hand, the approach we saw in the Maharil and in the Abu Draham, quoted by numerous others, that you're talking about the gematria to be able to work out the numbers, that they both come out to 502. So again, unless you had those specific words, Haman and Mordechai are not equal, so you need some other words on each side in order to equal it out. So they'll say, again, that's there in order to create this mathematical challenge, which again, in both of these cases, you're not dealing with let's put it this way. If it means literally the difference between good and evil, you're talking about an incredible amount of drink, which I don't know if a person can really get there, versus getting to the point of not being able to do some singing or some simple math. And as I said, there's a huge difference between these opinions. The Vilna Gaon takes it totally intellectual and philosophical. And he says that when you drink on Purim, you're supposed to drink, and when you drink, you're supposed to consider the following philosophical question. What is really the miracle of Purim? Is it that somebody who's evil gets destroyed? Or is it that somebody who's good ends up getting rewarded? Which means, here's a philosophical question in life. What bothers you more, that bad things happen to good people or that good things happen to bad people? And when you finally get to the point that something good happens to someone good and something bad happens to somebody bad, which of these is a greater aspect of God being involved in this world? Which is the greater miracle? So he says that, again, totally a philosophical question. You should drink, and that's the question that should be discussed and be thought about during your Purim Seudah. That's the Vilna Gaon's approach. And there are others who follow, again, are not that far from his approach. But again, he's not at all saying that you get drunk to the point you can't tell the difference between good and evil. He's saying is you drink to the point that you then contemplate this question about good prospering or evil prospering, as the case may be. What's the matter? You can't do it without drinking. You can.
No. If you're not happy that evil gets destroyed, then evil will destroy good, and that's the reason that you're happy that evil gets destroyed. It's not like you.
I understand. So he says that that's the question that you should be thinking about, is that there were many miracles that took place on Purim. What's the biggest miracle? The end of the story that Mordechai gets elevated, or a little bit before that when Haman gets pushed down? He goes, that's the question to think about. That's the, excuse me? Right. Maybe in the spirit of Purim, I'll try to explain why Rabba killed Reb Zera, but then I'll come back to a couple more. Get back to the halachic conclusion. What's the matter? You good? So, see, there are those, notably the Maharsha, who say that the story of Rabba killing Reb Zera is very unlikely, and he goes on to explain. I didn't put the Marsha here for, I don't know for what reason, but I didn't. The Marsha says that the whole thing is a euphemism. That when it says that he shechted him, what it really means is that he made him drink more than he was accustomed to. And the word shechting means to make somebody getting drunk, which is a very nice interpretation except for one problem. I don't believe, well, then he felt better the next day. I don't believe there's even one instance in the Gemara or rabbinic literature that he can bring as evidence that the word shchita is a euphemism for getting drunk. Meaning if he can bring one piece of evidence, even one case, so then I would feel much better about that, but therefore it seems much more like a cover-up than it seems to be. Although the rationalists among us, if there are any, I don't know if you could be a rationalist and live in this country, but the rationalists among us may prefer the approach that he really didn't kill him and he really didn't bring him back to life, or that he gave him a little too much to drink, and then he helped him feel better the next day. But the Gemara at face value seems to say that he killed him and he brought him back to life. Now, both of those elements bother us. It bothers us, one, that this person killed another person, and we would like to know motive, we'd like to know why he did it. On the other hand, it bothers us that that the Gemara can tell us that he brought us back to life. So let me just point out a couple of things. As I said, you can do this as you like. Maybe even this you could tell over on Purim, because on Purim you can say anything. There's a question in the Gemara which is completely unrelated to this point. The question is, when you perform shechita, and for the vegetarians among us or people who are vegetarians temporarily, I apologize for this, but the Gemara says that, you know, when you take a knife and you need to perform shechita, the knife needs to be exceedingly sharp. And the knife should be able to make a very smooth cut. If you have to do like a sawing motion, this isn't good. Okay, I'll stop. But the Gemara has a question. What happens if the knife of shechita, you're vegetarian? You're about to be. what happens if you take the knife from shechita? This is one of these questions, which is a total theoretical, that you have to kind of wonder if rabbis have like way too much time on their hands. Okay? And the question was, what happens if you take a knife and you made it red hot or white hot, as the case may be, and you perform the shechita with a knife which is, again, absolutely red hot? The question is, will the animal feel, theoretically in shechita, the animal won't feel anything, which is why you have the phrase, a chicken without a head. Chicken won't know it's missing its head if it's really done properly. But if you do shechita and the animal doesn't feel the thing, but what happens if the knife is white hot or red hot and the shechita is performed? Will the animal feel the heat? Will it be killed by the heat of the knife, or will it be killed by the sharpness of the knife? That's the question which is debated in the Gemara. How do you resolve such a question? So you know what the Gemara says? This the Gemara.
You have to bring it back to life, and you ask them, what
So look at source number four. Who is the person who gives an opinion regarding what happens? It is our victim, Reb Zera. Reb Zera, Mishmuel, Libin, Sakin, Vishachatpa, if you made a knife white hot and you did Shechita, Shechita tok Shera, the Shechita is kosher, Chiduda, Kodem, Lelibuna, the sharpness comes before the heat. That by the time the heat
that
could even...
That didn't happen anyway.
Excuse me?
That's because it didn't happen anyway, the whole story, because he's wrong.
I don't know.
No, I'm just guessing.
I don't know.
Like,
I don't know.
Right.
No, okay, good. But Reb Zera was the one that Shechita was performed on,
right?
And he in our story, and he's the one, and he's right. We don't have to. What's very interesting is why he has an opinion, which means of all the people in the Gemara, Reb Zera is the one who says, "No, this is the opinion which is the right opinion," and this is a different place. It pops up completely independent. That was Megillah. They don't assume anything. They don't assume anything. But again, this is very interesting. So now you can go, and as I said, this is a total construct, you know, theoretical construct. You can say, yes, I am assuming that. And I'll show you another one, which just 1 second. Okay. Good. Exactly. Now, 1 second. Calm down a little bit over here. As I said, you'll have something to talk about now on Purim. But think a little bit. We have this Gemara, which I'm claiming that would have happened afterwards. And now, as all of you have suggested, maybe this is what these rabbis discussed when they got drunk. And they're discussing this particular question. One says it's the heat. The other says it's the sharpness. It's the heat. It's the sharpness. And he says, I'll prove it to you. Go ahead. How are you going to prove it? And he slits his throat. Now, if you don't like this part of it, I have a couple of different elements still to say. So far, I just showed you one Gemara, but there's another Gemara which is very interesting, which I think may be related as well. But before we look at the Gemara, what's Judaism's attitudes towards astrology? Which means, do we think that the whole thing is a hoax, or does the Gemara consider that astrology is something which is real? So what's the answer? The Gemara considers it to be real, but not absolute, which means... there's a Gemara, and this is the one I'm about to quote, a little couple lines before, it says, Ein Mazal Yisrael. What does Ein Mazal Yisrael? It doesn't mean Jews got no luck. What does Ein Mazal Yisrael mean? It means that Jews are not controlled by the Mazalot, by the constellations, which is also interesting. When you say to somebody, Mazal Tov, which literally means, may you be in a good constellation, right? Or when somebody is in a bad constellation, what do you call them in Yiddish? A Shlemazel, right? He's not in a very good constellation. And we don't really pay attention to it because that's not what the words mean to us as we use them. But the Gemara does consider that astrology has significance. A matter of fact, it says that it will create certain characteristics, but the Gemara insists that you have free choice in order to utilize the characteristics in whatever way you choose. The Gemara considers anybody who's born under the sign of Mars, and I don't know how these things work that well, but if you're born into the sign of Mars, this will be an indication that you will be a spiller of blood. Okay, let's look at the Gemara, source 6. Hai man tibima adim. The individual who is born under the sign of Mars. By the way, it's very interesting. What does the Gemara call Mars? Ma'adim. Why is it called Ma'adim? I am in 6. Because it's a red planet, which is presumably something that you can see with the naked... What?
Esav,
Edom. But correct. Ma'adim is the red planet, and Esav is a spiller of blood, and so on. Therefore, if you're born under the sign of Mars, and again, the Gemara... I believe you can see Mars with the naked eye, but you just need to know exactly where and when to be looking. In Canada, it's red. If you're born under Mars, Yihi Gavar Ashayid Dama, you will become a person who's a spiller of blood. Amar Rav Ashi, but Rav Ashi then says, but you still have free will. I Umna, I Ganva. You can become a surgeon, or you can become a thief who uses a knife. I Tabcha, you become a butcher. I Moala, you can become someone with a circumcision. Amar Rabba is very surprised at this, and he says, Anu b'ma'adim havai, I was born under the sign of Mars, and you don't see me going killing people. I would assume, if you're going to ask me again about chronology, I would assume that this Gemara is before that fateful Purim day when he had a few too many with Reb Zera. And by the way, the Gemara's answer, Amar Abaye, says, Amar Mar, Nami Anosh V'Katil. You also, as a judge, you also give punishments and take your pound of flesh, as it were. Which is saying that, but you're doing this as a judge, but this goes back to something deep within your personality. So if this is the case, so what? Alcohol does a couple things for you, correct? One, alcohol is a great depressant, which is why depressed people drink it, but and it's not good for them. But alcohol does something else, and that you also know, takes away inhibitions. So if you have somebody who has this tendency towards a spilling of blood, and something which he may not even himself be in touch with, and his controls are let's say, in place, but he has a few too many, and we get back to our, it's the sharpness, it's the heat, it's the sharpness, it's the heat, and Rabba, having too many, pulls out the knife and slits Reb Zera's throat. So I'm just giving you, again, a couple more gemaras, and I'll give you one more, which could take us very, very far, which we're going to try not to go too far. And you all have presumably at some point in your lives have heard about a legend of the golem, correct? Do you know anything about the golem, about the legend, or where it talks about it? So, okay, so you have the most famous incident about the golem, and that is the golem from Prague. The problem about the golem from Prague is that there is virtually no historical evidence to it. The Maharal died in 1609, and the evidence about it was written by a man named Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg in 1909, or he published it in 1909, claiming that he found it in some ancient library in the Royal Library of a city called Mainz, which here in English notes is M-A-I-N-Z, and it became very, very popular. This is not to say that it's impossible that the Maharal did it, but if you know the famous story, the story was that it was a blood libel, and right, they took a Christian kid, died, took the body, they hid it in the shul, the Maharal found out about it, and he made this golem. He made a person somehow out of clay, and the person took the dead body, put it back in the Christian community, and the Jews were saved. That's the story of the Maharal. The problem with the story is that it is very unlikely that it happened. There's no historical evidence that there were any blood libels in Prague at the time. None of the Maharal's students, children, grandchildren, or students of students know about the story or write about the story or tell about the story. That's what makes it a little bit problematic. This fellow, Reb Yudel Rosenberg, who wrote about it and published it, he claims that he found it. As I said, he found the manuscript. He, a couple years later, said he found another manuscript, which was just as fascinating, and that manuscript told about the Maharal and the breastplate of the high priest, of the Kohen Gadol, which is, again, this week's parsha, the Kohen Gadol and the breastplate. And he says that what happened was is that the breastplate ended up in Rome, and from Rome it was put on loan in a library in London, and from London it was stolen, and these guys who stole it were able to do all kinds of tricks with the Choshen, and the Maharal found out about it, traveled from Prague to London, and while he was in London, he used all kinds of Kabbalistic tricks to get these guys to return it and to do tshuva and so on. Now, the problem with that story is that, and by the way, this story he also says he found in the same library in the same special place. Now, the only problem with that story is that there's a very, very similar story that was written a couple years before with a couple of changes. It was written by somebody named Arthur Conan Doyle. And instead of the Maharal in the lead role, you have Sherlock Holmes in the lead role. And this he also, as I said he found in the same library, which causes certain people to question, to question the veracity of the Maharal stories. And most likely, Rabbi Rosenberg, who later became the chief rabbi of Montreal, and had a grandson who also became a famous writer, Mordechai Rischler. And Yudel Rosenberg most likely was simply writing fiction. But what happens when you write fiction and people believe your fiction? He also lived in Toronto for a couple of years. But what happens when you write fiction and people think your fiction is nonfiction? So then how do you break it to them that this is really nonfiction? So that's the most famous Maharal, the most famous golem stories. On the other hand, we do have all kinds of evidence, which you like or not like, but we do have evidence of people writing about golems, including Rav Yaakov Emden telling us that his great-great-grandfather did one, and he tells us many, many details about it, which means there have been stories about legends of, of this ability to make a golem, but the Gemara speaks about it. And by the way, Shelley and the whole Frankenstein legend comes from the golem, especially from, if you were to read Rav Yaakov Emden's description of the making of the golem and the problems that it caused and how they stopped it, try to kill its maker and so on, you'll realize the whole Shelley story is taken from the tshuva of Yaakov Emden. Okay, but let's. I'm being a little superficial right now. I don't know. But listen, these kinds of stories also become folk. They also become folk stories afterwards. And the stories of the Maharal were quite famous. Only question is, did they ever happen? Before Rosenberg wrote about the Maharal, there were other legends that Maharal was connected to this. But all the details that he put into it seemed to be fantasy, including the blood libel and so on. Could the Maharal have been involved in such a thing? Certainly. But the way that the story is known doesn't work that well. Okay, a couple more things. According to legend, the way that you make this is by studying a book which is called the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation. It's a mystical tractate which, depending who you ask, may go all the way back to Adam or to Avram or to Rabbi Akiva, or it's not clear, but it is an ancient mystical book. The main concept of the Sefer Yetzirah is that by use or manipulation of letters, you're able to create. Why? Because God creates by speech. When God speaks, the world comes into being. God said, "Let there be light." Speech is made up of words. Words is language. Language and words are made up of letters. So therefore, God needed to create letters and words and language in order for there to be creation. This is part of how God creates. So therefore, theoretically, if we understood the use of letters properly, we would be able to create. And therefore, speech is very closely related to creating, and therefore creation takes place by speech. How do you say that in Aramaic? Abracadabra. I create by speech. Abra ka'adabra. By speaking, I create. And that's your abracadabra. Very good. Source number 5. Amar Rava. By the way, it's interesting, we're back to Rava again over here. He's also the one who introduced the first source. Amar Rava. Rava said, number 5. Iboid sadike. If the righteous people wanted to, boru alma, they would be able to create a world. Shenemar, for it says, ki im avonotechem hayum avdilim b'nei uv'neichem. It is your sins that separate me and you, which means God creates us in the image of God. God is a creator. Theoretically, we should be able to create. What is it that prevents us from being able to create? The fact that we are imperfect. Rava, and again over here, the... Over here, by the way, the manuscript, or even the side of the printed Gemara, says Rabba. Rabba bara gavra, Rabba made a man, shadre lekameh derabbi Zera. And when he made this man, again, using the Sefer Yetzirah, Rashi explains, using this manipulation, he sends him to Rabbi Zera. What happens? Hava kam ishtoi bahadeh, he speaks to him, v'lo hava kam ahadrelay, and he doesn't respond to him. Amr Leiman Chavrayat. He goes, you must be made from one of the magicians. Hadar la'afarich. Return to dust. What's bothering Reb Zera? Again, just to understand this, it seems to be that the thing that was made, and there's many different opinions about this, but it seems to be, I'm again saying this as simply as I can, that this particular humanoid who's created can't speak. If he can't speak, it shows imperfection, so it shows the person who's making him is not exactly like God, who God creates through speech, and someone who can speak. So his inability to speak is shown as imperfection. So Rabba creates someone and sends them to Reb Zera, and Reb Zera says, no, that's not really good enough. I would be very tempted to use this story and say this is the continuation of the story in terms of the miracles. Look, let's consider something. If I were, and maybe I shouldn't, if I were to take the Gemara literally, that Rabba kills Reb Zera and brings him back to life, that's very impressive. Afterwards, Rabba says to Reb Zera, come, let's drink again. Reb Zera says, no, miracles don't happen every day. What's Rabba's response to that? He makes a golem and he sends it to him. He says, no, I can do these things. And what's Reb Zera's response? And the response may be very sharp, because the response is, no, it's imperfect, because he can't speak. And what would that seem to imply, that his opinion is? That Rabba is also imperfect, which may be why he's staying away from him. Okay, so again, my all of these Gemaras may be not related at all. They may be completely separate from one another. But when you put them all together, you have motive. You have whatever opportunity. You could put together the larger picture in terms of the discussion, in terms of Rabbah's own background and his basic characteristics. As I said, everything I may have said was wrong, but hopefully it's at least interesting. Nonetheless, we still have a problem. And what's our problem? Our problem is, what does this story do to the obligation in terms of drinking? If we were to look in the Me'iri in source number 8, Chayev Adam laharbot b'simcha b'yom zeh, uvachila v'shtiyat shalei yachsar shum davar. Person should eat and drink on this day till nothing should be lacking. U'mikol makom einanu mitzuvim lehishtaker. Nonetheless, you're not obligated to get drunk. Ula havchit atzmenu, and to debase ourselves, mitocha simcha, from the happiness. Shalon etzdaveno simcha sheholulut v'shel shtut. We're not obligated to do stupid things. Ela b'simcha shel ta'anug, the simcha should be one of enjoyment. Shnagiyah mitocha lavat Hashem, the objective of being happy on Purim is to get to love of God. V'hoda ahonisim sha'asu lanu, and to thank God for the miracles that took place. Regarding the assertion, you should drink till you don't know the difference between literally good and evil, some of the Gaonim already made reference to, you notice it's Rava here in both cases. So I'm saying, you just have a lot of confusion all the way around. Was it Rava all the time, or Rava all the time, or a combination? But he says, that which it says later, that Rava got up and shachti the Rabzera and killed Rabzera, nidchu kol otam hadvarim, that this comes to reject the teaching, which means, how does he understand the juxtaposition? The fact that you have a tragedy told right after the obligation destroys the obligation.
So is this a mistake that he writes here,
Rava? I'm telling you, it's too easy of a mistake. So it happens in every single time you have Rava, you have to be concerned it's Rava or Rava, it's Rava, and I can't tell you who it really is. I told you, you look in that tshuva of Rabbi Klein, and he talks about it. But Talmud Ma'arav, what does it say in the Jerusalem Talmud? Shetzarech lomar achar mikra megila oror haman baruch mordechai brucha esta ruur zerech shvachin shetzarech lomar charbona zachor latov v'amo shechayv lit basem ad shelo yod bebirur ma yomar. You should drink till you get confused in the singing. He then adds another opinion. The Rambam is ad sheyiradem, till you fall asleep. V'chein le'inyan b'irzeh she'amar shachta l'abzera purish meloshin tzchita. And then he also tries to change the word around. Maybe it doesn't really mean that he shechted, maybe in something else. Nonetheless, the Me'iri gives us a bunch of opinions of limiting the drinking, but the most significant of all of them, I think, is when he says that no, but we just don't accept the opinion that you have to drink. The Maharil is like the Budraham. He mentions the Gematria, and he's quoting it, so obviously they're not the first ones to say this. Okay. The Tur, in source 12, he quotes it at face value. Why is the Tur quoted at face value? Most likely because his father, if I'm not mistaken, the Rush, quoted at face value. Mitzvah labrot besuda purim v'tzerech lishtaker atchli yodamein orham and levarach mordechai. Drink. The Beit Yosef, which, again, keep in mind, the Beit Yosef is Rav Yosef Karo, who will be writing the Shulchan Aruch, which we'll see in a second. He says, and by the way, what did he tell us? He told us, which we saw months and months ago, that you cannot understand his Shulchan Aruch unless you read the Beit Yosef. Because the Beit Yosef, he tells you what he really believes, and then in the Shulchan Aruch, he tells you in one line. So what does he write in the Beit Yosef? Mitzvah labrot besudat purim, mitzerech shishtaker ad shelo yodamein orham levarach mordechai. He says, where does that come from? That comes from the Gemara and so on in Megillah. V'katvu atosfot, he quotes the Tosfos regarding the singing of the songs. V'chein katav aran, I'm skipping a little bit. Klomar, de'i ben orer haman levarach mordechai l'chud. Because if this was really just between the knowledge of good and evil, that haman should be cursed, haman should be blessed, afilu shata tuva lo ta'i ba'i. Even if you drink an enormous amount, you're not going to get to that kind of mistake. V'katav aran, b'shem Rabbeinu Ephraim, which is really the person who the Me'iri quoted, from the fact that Rabba got up and killed Rabzera, Gemara says, idchile memra de Rava, that rejects the teaching of Rava that you're obligated to drink, v'lo shafir dami l'mavid hachi, and therefore one should not drink on Purim. We just read this together. That sounds to me very much like his conclusion. Katuv baruchat chayim, chay v'nish lepsumi bepuria, lo sheishtaker, it's not that you should get drunk, shahashichrut isur gamur, because getting drunk is prohibition in Torah. Ve'ein lecha aveira gdola mizu. You don't have anything else which is severe as this. Shehu goreim, because what does getting drunk lead to? Legili arayot, v'shvichut damim, v'kama aveirot zulatan. It leads to sexual sins, it leads to murder, and other choice sins as well. Rather, ach sheishte yoter milimudo ma'at. You drink more than you normally do. And that seems to be his conclusion. So now, what is, I don't want to say funny or tragic, now you after you read this whole thing, and I would ask you, does he seem to be saying, after everything that he quotes, is he telling you, but I think you should get drunk out of your mind? Or does he seem to be bringing all these opinions which limit it? Then, if you take the quote-unquote superficial read of halacha, how do you do that? You just read the Shulchan Aruch. What does the Shulchan Aruch say? Source 14. Chayiv inish levsumi b'puri adulayad ben Ur Haman levarach Mordechai. He just quotes that line from the Gemara. But when you read the Beit Yosef, what do you realize? That his understanding of drinking is not getting drunk out of your mind. It's maybe it's literally, what does he say? Sheyishte yoto milimudo. What does that mean? So the Hasidic understanding of this is yoter milimudo, you have to drink more than you learn. Which means the more you learn, the more you're allowed to drink. Yoter milimudo. But still, it seems to be that the Beit Yosef has a very negative opinion, and in the Shulchan Aruch, he just says it generally without qualifying himself at all. If we were to follow the instructions of the Shulchan Aruch, of Rav Yosef Karo, then we would not read the Shulchan Aruch by itself. We would read the Beit Yosef, and then you know what he really believes. I can assure you that most yeshiva students who even bother to look into this, most don't, will say, oh, he says you have to drink till you don't know the difference, and that's the bottom line. And I can assure you that that's not, at least I would strongly suspect that that's not his opinion. The Rama adds, v'yesh omrim de'ein tzarech l'shtaker kol kach. So the Rama apparently understood Rav Yosef Karo is just this one line. He goes, no, you have to drink so much. Drink more than you normally do. Now, who else said that? The Beit Yosef himself said that, which means they're agreeing over here. Drink more than you normally drink. The Yoshein and go to sleep. And once you're sleeping, when you're sleeping, then you don't know the difference and you won't be making much trouble. Then he adds, ve'echad hamarbeh, ve'echad hamimit, whether you do a lot or little, b'vad shichavein libo l'shamayim. That whatever you're doing, that your objective over here should be l'shem shamayim. The Mishnah Brura qualifies even a little bit more. Source 15, ben Ur Haman, shezeh ma'pala rishona shenital nikama rabba mimenu, va'od tuva yitera mizeh gedulat Mordechai shivchor, which is very similar to the Gra, which means, Or Haman to the Rech Mordechai, meaning these are the two miracles of the story, that Haman is destroyed and that Mordechai is blessed. Let me skip there a little bit. He then adds, where it's underlined on the next page, the Ayin Be'or Zarua, Demikol Makom, Yir Al Liot Zehir Be'inyan Netilat Yadayim, Uvir Chatamotzi, Uvir Chatamazon, Yesimcha Shel Mitzvah. And he spells this out much clearer, on top of page 4, he spells it out much clearer in the Bir Halacha, which is also his commentary, which is in source 16, where he essentially says, first he quotes the Meiri and Rabbeinu Ephraim, which was that whole negative approach to drinking generally. He then quotes the Chai Adam, around halfway through source 16, So he quotes this opinion, which we had seen already from the Rishonim, he quotes it from the Chai Adam, that you should be drinking more than normally because the whole miracle took place with drinking, in order to remember the miracle. But somebody who knows himself, if you are going to mess up any of the mitzvot, benetil yadayim, uver bracha, berkat amazon, o shelo yitpalel mincha, o ma'ariv, o shinhog chalot rosh, you know that you're going to end up doing breaking any kind of law. What does he say? Okay. Mutav shelo yishtaker. Then it's better not to drink. V'kol ma'asav yu l'shem shamayim. Rather, everything you do should be l'shem shamayim. Back a line, in the end of the previous source, Mishnah Berurah, hey, he writes, he's quoting the point where he says, go to sleep. V'yashem mitoch sheyashen, v'chein ra'oi la'asot. And that's what's worthwhile to do, which means apparently the Mishnah Berurah also does not believe that you should be getting drunk out of your mind. Rather, you should be drinking a little bit more than you normally drink and be happy and recognize the miracles took place. If you want to look for other opinions and look for those who say, yes, you should drink as much as possible, in source 17, the Shari Tshuva brings, and Rav Yaakov Emden writes this about his father, V'ayin b'sidur mudei shamayim she'katur she'aviv hagonzal haya noheg b'yimei bachurato l'kayim ha'memre kapshuto. That Rav Yaakov Emden writes about his father, who was the Chacham Tzvi. He says that he used to drink, and when he was young, he tried to do the mitzvah, literally, but he didn't continue in his later years. Source number 19, we're skipping 18 for the moment. Source number 19, I'm just bringing this as one, because if I go through the halachic sources, you would be very hard-pressed, other than what I just now read to you, to find a halachic source that says, yes, this is taken literally, you should drink as much as possible, drink to the point that you don't understand anything. And really what the Beit Yosef quoted before is, no, Judaism is about controls. Judaism is about doing proper things, not about getting away all inhibitions, because that leads to all kinds of sins, which is a very reasonable approach. But if I were, and I gave you today so far a pretty fair cross-section of the halachic opinions. You don't find the opinion saying get drunk out of your mind. On the other hand, if you start looking in books of machshava, books of Jewish thought, especially in Hasidic writings, then you find people talking about getting drunk beyond anything. And I'm just going to bring you one. I could bring you 30 pages of sources like this. Bless you. I'm just going to bring you one like this, but I'm making a distinction between halachic sources versus machshava sources. Source 19, Rav Tzadok HaKohen, V'zehu Purim Adilo Yada Shehigia L'Shurchoto Shalot. You should get, again, this is the objective, get to the point that you're drunk as Lot. By the way, what did Lot do when he got drunk as Lot? That was not a pretty scene, right? You remember how that worked out. You should get drunk as Lot. Shekoma Asav Kim Metasek Ba'alma She'en Lo Shumdat Lo B'tchilav Lo B'sof V'mekol Zeb Davuk B'Hashem Yitbarach. You should get drunk to the point that nothing makes sense anymore, but still in your innermost person, you're relating to God, which for him indicates some kind of profound connection to God. And you can read this 100 times. He still says this, but Rav Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin, you want to blow this up and put it by your in your dining room on Purim. there are other sources like this. And again, most of them, they are the Hasidic sources, the Machshava sources, that try to find some kind of philosophical or mystical rationale why getting drunk beyond any knowledge is going to be a wonderful thing.
Why would he bring up love?
Because Lot got drunk.
Why bring up that story? Because the Mashiach comes.
But you can work very hard and you can try to figure out. But it's if you want next year, of course, a class on all the machshava points about why you should drink on Purim, I'll be very happy to bring them. But I do have to point out that they're not there in the halacha points. I want to get to one last source for today, and that is in source 18, which is my favorite in the whole thing, which is the Yad Ephraim, written by Rav Ephraim Margoliot. It's one of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. You'll notice the Yad Ephraim. You know, if you open up a Shulchan Aruch, sometimes you get lost there because you have a big Aleph, a little Aleph, a funny Aleph, a Rashi Aleph, and each one goes to a different commentary. How do you know when it's the Yad Ephraim? The printer put a Yad. So there's a Yad on the page, a hand. So if there's a hand on the page, it means they go on the side to the commentary called the Yad Ephraim. So the Yad Ephraim writes, Rabim rotzim l'tareitz l'faresh ma'kavana b'zeh, what it means in terms of drinking on Purim, why it means adelo yad, and so on. V'liat sa'ir nitperesh b'chazon laila. Yes, he says what you just now think he said. In the middle of a dream, he had an epiphany, and he realized what the correct interpretation is. Shekavana hu, she'ikara chiyuv shel mishteh, hu she'yesh sharoi b'simcha. What's the main objective? To be happy. K'dichli v'yayin yismach levav enosh. Right? That wine makes you happy. And once you're happy, you should take joy from God. You should, in your situation of joy, be able to thank God for the miracle. Therefore, you certainly should not be drinking too much, because then you're going to get confused. And then you're not going to recognize the miracle at all. Right. And that which it says you should drink until you don't know, hach adhu velo ad bichlal. That means whenever you have the word ad, or ad means till. So is ad inclusive or exclusive? If I say walk to the house there, did I mean walk to the front of the house or walk inside the house? Walk until the house. Ad habayitazeh. Which means ad, is it inclusive or exclusive? So he says, Ratzalomar, adhu velo ad bichlal. It means you should drink till this point, but if you got to the point you don't know, that means you drunk too much. And the basic teaching in the beginning was, don't drink too much. Chayv influmi ad lo yada. Don't drink to that point that you don't know. Ratzalomar, shagadu chivashtiya bezelev sume ad gvul de lo yada. That you should get to the border of that. Shemina gvula zeva hala. But if you drink too much, hu bitu kavanat chiyuv shechivu chachamim. Livsume, then you've drunken too much. Kadesh yitain halevel adal shekivin shitpalel dato. Then you get confused. Kolkach dulo yada ben orham. Then you won't know it. Pshita she'en bo dat v'tfuna l'shevach l'fa'erot tokef anes. Then you certainly cannot thank God if you don't know anything. V'et bonein alav baboker. And when I woke up in the morning, I thought about the interpretation that occurred to me. V're'iti ki nachonu. And I saw that it was correct. U'miyushav b'zeh b'shebishas samchulo inyan uv d'durav rebzera. To avdu suda purim badadi, and that's why the Gemara puts that story right afterwards. Shelachora hu maaseh l'stor, because at first glance this story comes to contradict the obligation to drink. V'ktzat poskim katfu shekavanahu shemizeh yesh lamod she'ena l'chakirava baha. And some people rarely write that this story is put there to tell you that the law is not like Rava. Ulafima shekatavti, regarding what I suggested, Yeshloma da Arderaba, mighty Saita, it brings proof, it's support. Saita deshmaya means support from heaven. It brings support, mize shema shechivu lasot otam yemei mishteh v'simcha gvul yeshlo shalosh lakar yoter midai. That there's a border over here not to drink too much, which means as far as the Yad Ephraim is concerned, that there is a mitzvah to drink on Purim, and a mitzvah to drink a little bit more than you normally drink, but the Gemara is saying, but don't drink too much. And the story comes to support the idea of not drinking too much. The conclusion for today, by the way, when I teach this before Purim, it's always different from what happens on Purim, but the conclusion is that one should drink on Purim, one should drink a little bit more than you normally drink. If one drinks, if one knows themselves and that by drinking they will get sick or they will not have simcha, then they should not drink. If a person knows themselves that by drinking they will do anything within halacha which is wrong, then one should not drink. We saw this opinion that the preferable thing to do is to drink and then go to sleep, which is a wonderful thing, then you don't have to clean up. The correct. Correct, and if you follow what I said in the beginning and only stay with drinking wine, then obviously you're talking about a completely different type of. Well, depends how much wine you drink. Yes.
Maybe you mentioned it in the beginning. So for women,
I have no idea why women should be any different. It was actually brought that, and I saw it was quoted by the Stipler, that he told his daughters and granddaughters that Purim they should drink a little bit more than they normally do. And his sons and grandsons saying, what are you talking about? Who ever heard of women drinking? So he said, why should drinking be any different for women than for men? I mean, I if it's part of Su'udat Purim, which it is, and if you look for the laws of drinking, they're always brought in within the context of Su'udat Purim. Why should Su'udat Purim be different for men than for women? Makes no sense whatsoever. But if you listen to everything that I've said, then correct. It should be wine, and it should be only wine. It should be wine if you think that this will help you in terms of Yavat Hashem. You drink a little bit more than you normally drink, and hopefully that takes away some inhibitions, but not too many, and that you're able to recognize the simcha of the nes.
Again,
and you're drinking with the meal. You're drinking with food, which
makes the alcohol.
Correct. Correct. Which means the whole thing. I'm going to go back to the beginning. Purim is a rabbinic holiday, and part of the rabbis needed to say, well, what is going to be the nature of this holiday? So what the rabbis did is they say, you need to have a festive meal. The festive meal should include drinking. Being that the miracle of Purim took place with drinking, so you should be drinking a little bit more wine than you would normally drink. That's the mitzvah of Purim. Those who turn the objective of Purim into getting to drunk as you possibly can, I mean, I think, again, based on everything that we've seen today, I think that's a very weak thing. It's a very weak argument. Can you find all kind of philosophical or machshava or Hasidic writings who will start trying to explain why drinking is so important? Ad lo yada, from the Eitz Hadat Tov Hara, you have to get back to the point of before the sin of Adam and Chava, and you can go on and on and on about why drinking is so important. But the main thing is to recognize that an incredible miracle took place, let a miracle take place, and to thank God for that miracle. Purim Sameach.